What's up, everybody, and welcome to episode number 127 of Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host, Ray, aka All Day Ray, aka Wally Balls. And I'm joined here by my illustrious co-host, former market maker, 20 years and current day retail trader and educator, like a right hand on the Bible. This man is the truth, the heartthrob of House Street. JJ, how's it going?
Good brother, that's quite an introduction. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, man. Staying safe down here. And our guest today, he is the founder and the CEO of Professional Capital Management. He's built and sold a number of successful businesses while also investing in approximately 200 companies. He created and manages one of the largest independent financial media platforms in the world, a published author of the book, How to Live an Extraordinary Life. Of course, I'm talking about Anthony Pompliano. Pomp, how's it going, man?
Doing great. Thank you guys so much for having me again.
We really
Anytime.
appreciate you coming back on, man. So yeah, for the listeners, the first time we had you on was episode, oh, let me see right here. Episode 56, which was January 29th, 2001. So that was interesting time period. I think we had like the Reddit trading, like the GameStop, AMC going on. Retail participation was an all-time high. Pomp, I know you look at like a lot of data, you research all these different reports. I think I've seen like retail participation. I mean, especially obviously since that time period's been down a little bit. Where are we at with retail participation in markets?
I think that there's been a rise of self-directed investors that is not just one period of time or one asset. What's interesting to me is it's more of a technology story than it is a finance story. So if you think the self-directed investor or retail investor, historically, even if they wanted to trade in markets, it was very difficult for them to do that. They'd have to call up a broker, they'd have to get a financial advisor. You know, it was very much funneled through kind of the incumbent large kind of bureaucratic organizations. Today, we now have a bunch of technology that's been built. You know, maybe the Robinhoods, the Publix are kind of the best known versions of this, but there's many others as well. You have a rise of robo advisors, et cetera. And so you get technology that now has increased access, kind of brought down that friction for people to participate directly in the market without having to go through the incumbents. But on top of that, you also have a velocity of information as well. So you have a more informed self-directed investor base, and then you have the much easier way for them to access markets. And so those two trends together has really led to this rise of self-directed investors. What's interesting to me about those individuals is that it goes back to the old adage, like no one's going to watch after your money better than you. And so we are shifting to a degree away from the financial advisors and those incumbents. Now, that doesn't mean that those companies are going to be in trouble because the pie is growing so quickly that they actually are growing as well. I think just from a percentage basis, you're seeing a very, very large rise in the self-directed investor base. And so I expect that trend to continue. As they get access to more information, they get access with more technology to markets, you're going to see more and more of those individuals that I think say, look, maybe I even give some of my money to the financial advisor or to, you know, the incumbent firm, but I'm going to keep some portion of the portfolio for me to go ahead and invest myself.
Right. And so I want to ask you something like, I guess like in similar respects, you know, we're seeing a huge participation, huge growth in the sports betting industry in America. And I remember coming across a study saying that there's more money being put into, you know, gambling, sports betting, maybe fantasy sports than I guess retail is putting into the stock market. I forget the specifics. Maybe this is something you've came across, but I remember you tweeting about something and it stuck with me to this day. That, you know, and I think I ultimately agree with it. You said something to the effect, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but like with the diminishing of the middle class, inflation, I guess people are looking at potentially looking at like gambling, or I mean, I guess maybe you can equate this to the stock market too. These people are, they don't see a way up financially in life, and that perhaps they're looking at this as a chance, you know, to hit big.
Yeah, so I think, you know, first of all, you got to look at what is the stock market? The stock market is a casino. It's a regulated casino. It has different odds than maybe other casinos. But at the end of the day, people are going there and they are wagering money. They are taking risk with the hope of getting a return. Now, if you confuse buying the S&P 500 for the roulette table, or for the lottery, then maybe you should, you know, be a little bit more careful. You should go get a financial advisor to help you kind of figure that out. But at the end of the day, you're still taking risks. You're still wagering money. It just has, you know, maybe different odds. Now, the reason why I start there is because at the end of the day, everyone in the market is a risk taker. They are a gambler. They're gambling with what they got for what they want or what they potentially can get in the future. No different than buying the lottery, right? So the casino analogy, people always have a hard time with because like, oh my God, it's not gambling, whatever.
Yeah.
But well, what about the state sanctioned lottery that is basically a tax on stupidity in America, right? Is they're just taking money from people who don't understand the odds or have lost hope, and they are using that to redirect or redistribute the funds somewhere else. So the stock market, if you think of it from that perspective, is where people are going to invest. Now, there are two different types of investors, if you put in very broad buckets. There is kind of timeless investing principle investors who tend to spend less than they make. They tend to buy assets by dollar cost averaging over time. They tend to be long-term oriented. They're not trading. They are, you know, very much focused on, hey, I have a day job. This investing thing is almost being treated like a savings account to some degree and just let the stocks continue to compound. That investor base has been there for a long time and will continue to be there for a long time. I would even myself put kind of traditional traders in that base, right? They're looking at trading from a sophisticated standpoint. There's data, there's a plan, there's like all of those things, right? So those are like the traditional people. But there's been this rise of like higher risk taking.
Mm-hmm.
And that crowd, I think a huge driver that no one wants to talk about is they've lost hope.
Yeah.
Right. And when you lose hope, what do you do? You begin to become desperate. And when you become desperate, you begin to take kind of the one in 100 shot at a financial return. And so a lot of people want to point at whether it's GameStop or any, you know, meme coins or whatever's going on in financial markets. And they're like, look at how dumb these people are. But what I've tried to highlight is put yourself in their seat. They work a job where their wages are growing slower than inflation. So they continue to fall further and further behind. They never were told that you had to invest to be able to protect and grow your purchasing power and your economic value. Mm-hmm. So they lived most of their life with all of their money in cash that got devalued away. And now they're realizing, wait a second, not only am I behind, but I'm falling further and further behind. I've lost hope. Home prices in America are up 47% over the last 4 years. Inflation, especially core inflation, is still up 50% higher than the 2% target. I don't get the raises at work that I thought I was going to get because there's this deflationary kind of rise of technology and automation. And so you start looking at that and you say, well, what would you do if you're in their seat? You probably would have to take a flyer. Yeah. And it's no different than the person who says, you know what? I'm in a bad situation. I'm going to go start a company. Like starting a company is actually an insane high risk activity. You're betting your time and your energy on something that has very low odds of success. But we celebrate entrepreneurship, and then we misunderstand when somebody goes in the market and says, well, rather than me start the company, let me just take a flyer on somebody else's company. And so again, I'm not saying that one is good, one is bad, but what I am saying is if you try to put yourself in their shoes, you can understand why they're doing it. Whether you disagree, you can disagree with the action, but you can understand the kind of thought process. And I think if the more people can understand the thought process, they begin to realize if you want to solve these problems, you got to go to the root cause. And the root cause is we're devaluing the currency, right? We've got idiots who are spending whatever money they possibly can as politicians. And then you've got a lack of financial education in schools where people are basically getting thrown into the real world, ill-equipped to navigate what is probably the most important part of their life, which is their finances.
Yeah, it was a great
hit the nail on the head. Excuse me for jumping in. Wow.
Yeah. No, I haven't heard anyone else have that like nuanced take, which, you know, like when you tweeted this out, I was like, man, like it hit me hard because, like, you know, I have a bunch of friends are echoing like essentially what you said. And, you know, I brought up the sports gambling and like the fantasy part, cause like I'm big into playing fantasy sports on Underdog, and I've seen the growth of the games. I mean, all these things are going to advertise on TV, and like people know I do these things and they're asking me questions left and right. And I think you nailed it on the head, cause a lot of these people are in more or less like, not desperate situations, but they don't see any really any hope, really. And that's what they're looking at. So I'm just going to take a quick time out here to announce that our own micro e-futures trading room is now offering a 7-day free trial with no obligations, offering not only ES, where JJ teaches and trades, but other futures, instruments, stocks, crypto. And for people of my caliber, we're looking at DFS and sports betting, which I'm highly active in. Again, that's a 7-day free trial, no obligations or commitment. Come join us at microefutures.com. Yeah, like the, you know, these more and more people coming into the fantasy sports has actually been great for obviously the people who are, you know, sharper thinking analytically. But yeah, just interesting times right now. Pomp, transitioning a little bit. What do you think about, you know, the economic data and reports that we get from these different government agencies in terms of their reliability, usefulness, truthfulness, even?
We could spend hours discussing a lot here. And maybe the most important part is the direction is more important than the specifics, in my experience. The problem with economic data is it's nearly impossible to accurately capture the source information, which then you use various methodologies, which are flawed, to evaluate and produce your final metrics. And so I'll give you a couple of examples that I think people may be surprised by. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has a couple hundred people that are employed that in order to get prices at, let's say, a grocery store, they physically send people into the grocery store with a tablet, and those people may have multiple pages of description to make sure that they're looking at the exact same Campbell's soup with low salt, you know, with added chicken, 12 ounces, you know, all of the details, make sure you get the same one, and then input what the price is at that grocery store. Now, the reason why that's absurd is one, it's obviously inefficient to have a couple hundred people crisscrossing the country looking for this stuff. But the second thing is, you ever think that a human may inaccurately input the information? That probably happens every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is, if we then take all of that data and we don't even use it to actually measure year over year changes in the price of those goods, because we've come up with some sort of weighted basket manipulation to the data.
Yeah.
And this idea of substitution, oh, if this goes up too much, you're not going to buy it anymore. You'll buy this other thing. So let's just swap it out of the index. You can very quickly see how the source data could potentially be kind of corrupted. You could see how the methodology becomes really hard to put your faith into. And then you start to look at things like the manipulation of the actual end metric and the incentive for the government to always put that in a positive light. And you say, you know what? The exact number probably is actually less important than the direction. Are we going up or are we going down? Is it getting better or is it getting worse? Right? Housing is another one that cracks me up. You know, they call people on the phone, and if you're a homeowner, they literally ask you, what do you think you could rent your house for? Well, like any friend that I've ever asked that question to, they say a number a lot higher than what they actually could rent it for.
Sure.
Right? And so you just naturally, like you're literally getting self-reported data. Now, here's why it today is such an important topic, is we have the ability to get, with technology, real-time data. If you want real-time pricing data for homes or rent, why don't we go to the Zillows, the Redfins, the Street Easies of the world, and just get daily data on what is the clearing price for homes being sold in an area or rents being finalized? If you want real estate or grocery store prices, why don't we hit an API at Kroger or Whole Foods or name your favorite place and get the real-time pricing and get hundreds of millions of data points a day and put that through some sort of computer program that allows us to then produce a real-time metric? We don't need to rely on a backwards-looking data point with this lagging information, because if the central bank is going to make monetary policy decisions, right? Look at the environment right now. They did a 50 basis point cut in September. We get a little bit hotter than anticipated inflation for the month of September. And so now the Fed is sitting there saying, okay, well, I got to look at backwards looking data to make a decision today to predict what's going to happen in the future. It's nearly impossible for a human to do that. And so That is like hardcore economic data. What I think becomes even more interesting is the jobs revision that happened a couple of weeks ago. There was almost a million jobs that had been created over the prior year or so. And everyone was celebrating that. Hey, strong economy, strong, you know, job growth. This looks good. And then they did a revision down and erased almost 100% of all the job growth over the previous 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that means that the narrative for a year of its strong labor market was not strong.
Yeah.
Once they tell you something and it's wrong, whether it's malicious or not, intentional or not, how do you trust it the next time? So we just got a monster job number in September, like over 250,000 net new jobs created. That sounds great. As soon as I saw the number, I said, I can't trust it.
Oof.
Because what happens if in a month or two, they just revise it down and it goes from 250 to 100,000, which that sounds like a crazy revision. Actually wouldn't be that crazy compared to the revisions they've done in the past. And so I think that's now where people are trying to figure out, okay, what can we trust? And I go back to, you probably can trust the direction, you can't trust the specifics. And so if, as an investor, you are making a different investment decision, whether job growth is 254 or 233, you're probably, you know, kind of missing the forest from the trees type stuff. Mm-hmm. But instead, if you can just say to yourself, you know what, we're creating jobs at some certain magnitude, or we're losing jobs at some certain magnitude, and I'm going to make directional, you know, kind of decisions based off of that, you'll probably be in pretty good shape. It's just really, really hard. And I'm always careful because, you know, I can complain with the best of them about this economic data stuff. There's a couple of people, there's companies like Trueflation and others trying to do a better job.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like the private market has offered up, you know, a 10x better solution. Mm-hmm. And so it's just really hard, right? Mm-hmm. And so like, usually I say like, hey, don't complain, just kind of try to compete. Sure. But it is so hard to collect this data and do this stuff that until the private market can show up and say, look, we have a 10x better solution, I think that, you know, unfortunately, this is one area of life where like, we're just complainers, right? And so like, you kind of got to do the best you can with what you got in terms of the data that they're providing.
Mm-hmm. I like that model. Don't complain, compete. Good stuff. Okay.
And thanks for, sorry, Ray, thank you for explaining how that data is collected, because I actually had no idea that's how it worked. So
it's crazy.
It's thanks for shedding light on that, because that really, wow, that method of collecting data, given this technological environment that we're in, is, you know, it's like sending carrier pigeons. It's weird.
I know. I guess the last thing I'll just ask on that topic, Pomp. I know some people might question, I mean, do you think they're earnest in their data collecting, or maybe leave a little, you know, I don't know, wiggle room or something to spin them narrative or whatever?
My guess is, you know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions.
Okay.
And so similar here, I don't think that there is anyone sitting behind like a curtain, you know, at the Fed or the Bureau of Labor Statistics or anywhere like that, saying with the cackle of like the evil billionaire, let me manipulate the data and, you know, I'm going to really get them this time. Although, you know, there's plenty of conspiracy theorists on Twitter who would love to think that's what's going on. I don't think that. My guess is that it's a really hard problem. And the reason why people in the private market haven't necessarily come up with something better is because they also struggle with this. And so if you want to create a better system, then it really comes down to, how do you combine data analytics, technologists, economists, mathematicians, right? I mean, there's a lot that goes into this thing. Right. And so that to me seems like an area for maybe something to be built. But it also means like, don't run into it as like, hey, they're just manipulating this nefariously and it's going to be so easy.
Yeah.
You know, I think that what we're watching is just them saying to themselves, hey, this is hard. And, you know, it's okay. We can all admit, hey, this is hard, but also say, and you're wrong, right? Like, yeah. you know, two things can be true. And I think in this case they probably are.
Cool, for sure. I'm sure you've heard about the HBO produced Satoshi documentary. I don't know if it's out yet, but I know it was leaked. The guy they claim is Satoshi Peter Todd. He's coming out. He's vehemently denying it. Have you seen this? Like, do you know who Peter Todd is?
I do know who Peter Todd is. He's very vehemently denying that he is Satoshi.
Yeah. Who is do you mind just giving us like a little background on him? Because I wasn't aware of who he was.
Yeah, so Peter, he's one of the early Bitcoin developers. He's been around for a very long time. They essentially in the document, I haven't watched the full documentary, so I'm kind of paraphrasing here from some summaries I saw. But my understanding is that they went back and they saw a couple of messages where, you know, they're trying to draw a line of like, hey, it looks like maybe somebody got confused at which account they were using. He made a comment to having destroyed Bitcoin in the past. Obviously, Satoshi's got a lot of Bitcoin that can't be accessed. And, you know, I kind of comment this whole conversation is just like, who cares? Mm-hmm. Like, who Satoshi is doesn't matter, right? It's the classic, like, we are all Satoshi. If Satoshi came back, they can't do anything different than you or I. Maybe the only difference is they can move their 800,000 Bitcoin, but other than that, like, Bitcoin has become bigger than Satoshi, which I think is part of the beauty of Bitcoin. But also, you know, two things can be true. People love a good mystery.
Yeah.
They love a good conspiracy theory, right? They love a good, you know, HBO doc that identifies the richest person that no one can identify or whatever. And so I think that's probably what we're watching is more that than anything.
For sure. I was glad because when I first heard that, I'm like, oh my God, I hope this is like not like good journalism or like they really got it. Like, I think it's best for him to stay anonymous. And I think it's just great for like the lore of Bitcoin and all of that. And like you said, the mysterious access as well. So as far as inflows have gone, Pomp, I believe the BTC, like the ETF launches were the most successful in history, if I'm not mistaken. Are you surprised that the price hasn't moved much since? Or it's, I mean, maybe even gone down a little bit. And also considering that we've had the halving as well.
So it's funny because, you know, the ETFs were approved in January of this year. Bitcoin has gone up. I think at one point it was up as much as 70% post that ETF approval. It hit a new all-time high. All-time high was like 69,000, went to like, I think 73,000, somewhere around there. And then it drew down. I mean, it was back in the 50,000s, you know, kind of over the summer at one point. And we're sitting, you know, kind of low to mid 60,000s now. And so Bitcoin is still probably up 50% year to date, you know, give or take, which obviously is good. I think it's the best performing asset class, you know, and kind of all the traditional asset classes. But if I had told you, hey, the ETF's going to get approved, tens of billions of dollars is going to flow in, we're going to get the halving, all that, I think people are like, oh, why is it not up, you know, 300%, 500%? Right. I think two things are important to know. One, in halving years, so every 4 years this thing occurs, usually the price has not kicked off kind of a upwards movement until Q4 of that year. So you go back to 2020, I think the halving occurred, it was somewhere in the 8,000s. By the time that we actually started to go up, maybe Bitcoin was at 10K, but it was, you know, really in Q4, kind of late October, early November. And then it went from, you know, call it 10,000 to 64,000 by March of the following year. So kind of in a less than 6 month time period, it just ripped 600%. And so I'm not saying it's going to go up 600%. I do think that towards the end of October, sometime in November, we will get price to start, you know, kind of moving upwards. But I think the second thing that's important to understand is generally as an asset gets bigger, the volatility goes down. And so we have seen Bitcoin's volatility dropping over time. That does not mean that volatility is going to go to, you know, stock market returns of 8% a year. But it's probably not going to be, you know, 200% annualized returns. And so where do we end up there? My base case is it's lower than people expect, but it's higher than kind of other assets. And so one maybe caveat to that argument is these Bitcoin ETF options that recently were approved. They're not out yet, but they've been approved by the SEC. Those options have the potential, not the guarantee, but the potential to add more volatility. And so I had this guy from Bitwise on, Jeff Park, who kind of runs their alpha, you know, trading strategies. And he very, you know, vehemently believes, hey, these options are going to lead to more volatility. If that's true, you know, it could be a fun kind of Q4 of this year and Q1 of next year. It's just unclear right now, you know, how volatile will the asset be. But I do think time-wise, we're starting to get towards a period where we're going to see this thing, you know, move upwards.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and guys, definitely go listen to that. What was his name again from Bitwise? That was good. I was listening to that.
Jeff Park.
Yeah, we had on when they first launched the ETF, we had Hunter Horsley on from Bitwise as well. Really, really love those guys and what they're doing there. How do you envision the future of DeFi? Do you think this like continues to seep into what they call, I guess, TradFi, traditional finance?
It's a good question. I don't think that the DeFi story is as strong as maybe the fintech story. And again, if you look at it as like almost look at like you were evaluating from an investor base, right? There's like finance is the biggest bucket. And then you can drill down into like fintech, which is like all the technology that's intersecting with finance. And then you can drill down even, you know, more specific, and you can say, okay, there's like centralized and decentralized, you know, financial technology. DeFi obviously works. People are using it. You know, there's things that are very interesting there. But to me, what I think is kind of the bigger investment theme is the fintech story. And if you were to pick a theme that I think is really interesting inside of fintech, it would be automation. And this idea that like DeFi is kind of just a subset of automation happening in finance. What you're really doing, let's say with a decentralized exchange, is you're essentially stripping out the centralized services, the people, et cetera, and now you're using software to have an automated system. That happens with decentralized systems, but it also is happening with centralized systems as well. Right. And so the ownership structure, there are differences, but it's the automation story inside of fintech that I think is really going to drive the majority of the value. And so, you know, the machines are coming, right? Like they are going to be here. They are going to be able to allocate capital. And I think that people are very stuck on this idea of decentralization explicitly because, frankly, it's cool. It's kind of a middle finger to the traditional markets, yeah. Right? It's kind of like you don't control us. And I think that there is an element of everyone in finance who likes that. But I also think that there is an importance to understand that there's trade-offs with decentralization. And so I always use the example, like if Amazon was decentralized, it would kill the whole point of Amazon. Like Amazon is an efficient, hierarchical, you know, high-performance organization. Efficiency is the thing that they are trying to achieve, because if they get efficiency, they get low cost. If they get low cost, they get customers, right? Decentralized systems are not highly efficient and high performance. And so it's like, what are you optimizing for with these systems?
Good point. Great point. Pom, how do you see AI machine learning intersecting with crypto, blockchain, or I guess you could touch a little bit maybe on DeFi. Are these synergies worth exploring?
I think, again, it goes back to this idea that it's all kind of one big trade to me, mm-hmm. which is, you know, this like highly disruptive technology overlay on finance seems to me to be an area that people are almost underestimating because they're so stuck on like the individual technologies. They're like, oh, DeFi, and they're missing the what AI is going to do, or machine learning is going to do, or, you know, name your other technology. And so to me, what I try to do is I try to kind of zoom out or you know, kind of look at the playing field a little bit wider and say Bitcoin is a form of artificial intelligence. It's a programmatic monetary policy. We automated away the central bank, right? So you have AI, you have automation, it's decentralized, right? It's the original DeFi product. Like you kind of like see all those technologies wrapped into a single product and it works. And so I think that that is a good example of what we're going to see in some of these other areas, which is you're going to see a lot of the different disruptive technologies woven together.
Mm.
You know, I am a very, very small investor, but a very happy investor in Ramp, which is kind of this corporate card and kind of a finance platform. They use a lot of AI in their platform, but they also use a lot of other technologies, right? They use a lot of automation. They use a lot, like they're just trying to solve their customer's problem. And frankly, they don't care what the technology is. What they care about is, am I solving the customer's problem? I think that's part of the beauty of Bitcoin is like, it doesn't matter what the technology was because it works and it solves the customer's problem. And so how do you find things that really have that product market fit or solving the customer's problem, but understand that a lot of them are actually going to use multiple pieces of this technology. And it's a fintech story. It's not just a DeFi story, an AI story, an automation story.
Awesome. Real, real interesting. Are there any other exciting trends or maybe like companies you're seeing right now?
There's a lot. Let me not kind of name companies because everyone will just think I'm like shilling my investment portfolio. if I just kind of mention maybe the technologies, obviously, you know, Bitcoin, I think that their stable coins are very interesting as well. They definitely have product market fit. I think the smart contract platforms are going to continue to have success. I think that AI and machine learning are going to be very interesting. There's like the generative AI stuff, but I actually think what becomes quite interesting is, can you start to automate your personal finances? Can you start to automate purchasing? Can you start to use some of these technologies, not just for saving, but also for spending, for investing, like those types of things? I think there's a really interesting area around information for finance. How do you actually create the information? How do you summarize the information? How do you get the information to the right people? All that kind of stuff. I think that there is a lot of infrastructure in the legacy world that is going to get ripped out or replaced by people kind of disrupting it. I always call that like, that's the nerd stuff. You know, there's not that many people who really get excited about talking about, you know, 2-day settlement times of the, you know, DTCC and, you know, whatever. But like, there are people who do care about that and they're probably going to disrupt, you know, some of that stuff. And then, you know, one of the things that is an overarching theme that I'm very interested in, but I haven't yet seen enough people kind of building things where I'm like, okay, these are the solutions, is the machines are going to transact with each other. And when you start to see that, you know, one of the promises early on of like crypto was your car will have a digital wallet and it'll drive over something and your car's wallet will like pay the toll tax or whatever. And if you think about this, like the trend is definitely headed that way. We used to pull up to the toll, pull the change out of our pocket, hand it to someone, right? Then we got really smart. We're like, let's just automate the person. Like you can just throw the change into the little basket, right? And then someone's like, why don't we come up with the easy pass? I don't even have to stop. Like I just put it on my windshield, right? And then eventually it's going to be like, it just embedded into the car. So you can see like the progress is definitely towards automation and all that kind of stuff. What I wonder is, just like we've seen high frequency trading in the stock market, where else are things like that going to show up, right? You kind of see this with like Amazon's stores, where you can walk in, it uses facial recognition software, it knows who you are, it watches what you pick up at the store, and you just walk out.
Yep.
Pretty interesting experience.
It is.
Where else is that going to show up, right? And then it brings a whole kind of can of worms of privacy and you know, security and all that kind of stuff. But it just feels like that's where the world's going. And so, again, intuitively, I'm interested. Explicitly from an investment standpoint, it's not like I've got, oh, here's the three companies that, you know, I think are going to be like big winners there. And so I'm spending a lot of time, like one, just trying to think, hey, what do I think could happen there? But also two, trying to meet people who are building in and around that space so I can get educated based on what they think is going to happen, you know, kind of along those lines.
Cool. I know this question I'm about to ask here, Pomp, I know it's going to depend on, well, it may depend on who wins the presidency, but are there still like any regulatory concerns involving Bitcoin or crypto companies building in this space, or have a lot of these concerns been alleviated?
I think it depends on what part of the market. Bitcoin, I think, pretty much has been alleviated. I think even Ethereum now has been alleviated. I think in a weird way, the meme coins, the concerns there have been alleviated because people basically figured out, hey, if I launch a coin and I don't raise any money and it's a fair launch, then like it can't be a security. That's fascinating, right? Like there's a market solution to the regulatory lack of clarity. But there's like a middle ground, right? A middle area where people who did raise money or did do stuff. And I think that regulators are kind of working through all that to figure out, you know, who do they think is on the right side and wrong side of the rules.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's transition to this this new book you've recently published, How to Live an Extraordinary Life. Where'd the idea for the book come from?
When my first kid was born, my wife, she twisted my arm into writing a letter. And the first letter, frankly, was quite funny because it was basically just like, hey, I'm so excited you're coming. You're going to make me a dad. You know, like all the things that you would say that, you know, you're ill-prepared to be a father. And then I think it was the first birthday. My wife said, you should write another one. And that was more of like, hey, what do I actually want my kid to learn? Like, my kid's not going to read at one, right? She's going to read it when she's much older. And so I started thinking about that. And I wrote a second one. And then somewhere between like 5 and 10, I said to myself, like, hey, what if I like turn this into a book? And if I'm really honest with myself, I think part of it was I wanted it for my kids, but also I knew that I'd keep writing the letters if I kind of set a goal. You know, it was almost like a forcing function for myself. And so it sent me on this like 2-year journey of like really figuring out like, what are the things that I would want my kid to remember? And the hard part with writing a book like this is, the best advice is usually the simplest, right? And so you don't want to write a book that's like, you know, be a good person, like no shit, right? So you gotta find either kind of different ways to articulate this or memorable, you know, kind of phrases. And you really have to like, you know, try to get it across. And I don't even know if I was successful in doing that, frankly. Right. But I think, you know, so far, based on the feedback, like we did more of it than not, which, you know, is good.
Yeah.
But then also you got to understand that people have a very short times, like a attention span. And so the audio book is less than 3 hours. Right. The book is 250 pages or whatever, but it was written in a way where I knew that if you can get people to do this on a long drive and listen to it, or maybe on, you know, a rainy afternoon, if they can pick up the book and open it up to any page and start reading, and they don't have to have read any of the rest of the book, like all these little things, trying to build it for the attention spans of kind of modern society, then you got a shot, right? You got a shot to have a book that actually impacts people. Cause as I told the publisher, I said, listen, the first challenge with having a book that helps people is you got to get them to pick it up, right? Like if the book could be amazing, but if they don't pick it up at the bookstore, they don't buy it online, then like you're screwed. So that's one. Then two is they got to consume it. And if, you know, I got a lot of books in my office and stuff. Like there's some books I started reading, I'm like, dude, my head hurts. I just didn't finish it, right? And like, I want to, I'm sure there's information in there I need, but my head hurts. So you got to make it easy to read. You make it quick and snappy and all these things. And then the third thing is you got to make it easy for them to share. And so there's a lot of thought, I think, went into the layout and kind of how, you know, that there's photos that people can take and you know, do all this stuff. And so we're a couple of weeks in, you know, so far so good. The publisher refuses to tell me any data because I think they just want me to keep, you know, telling people about the book. And they tell after 1 month, they're going to tell me. So I'm going to find out with the rest of you guys. And my promise to everyone is I'm going to tweet out whatever the results are, good, bad, or anywhere in between.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. That's cool, man. Cause I know, you know, you mentioned the, I love that concept, like simplicity. And I know that's one of the chapters, simplicity signals mastery. I just think that's such a beautiful concept. One thing you said there, Pompa, I'm just curious to your, like, I guess personal thoughts on this. You got books around you. I'm sure you're a reader. You had to tailor the book to keep people's like attention spans in mind. And I'm sure like all authors do that, but like, I guess like nowadays people's attention span is even worse. Do you think that's kind of like, I don't know. It's like, you know, as a reader, I mean, like, I don't know if it's modern technology or whatever, but you think it's kind of just like a, I guess a knock on society that you had to make sure, you tailored it to short attention spans, or did you mean it in a fact that where you just were trying to make it interesting and like people to really like get captured by it?
One of the greatest things of modern society is that we have access to information. One of the greatest detractions in modern society is that we've got access to a lot of information, right? Our ancestors would be salivating to be able to have a supercomputer in their pocket that dings them every time something happens in the world. Amazing. There's a lot of people today that hate that thing that's in their pocket that dings them every time something happens in the world, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's this lost art of physical paper. And I haven't talked about this publicly, but I was talking to a friend about it yesterday, and he really made me think more critically about it. I have started to use physical paper more, which sounds almost crazy when you're like, dude, you have technology and finance, all this stuff. You got a computer or whatever. But I catch myself now wanting to not read stuff on my computer, print it out. Let me read the physical paper. It gets my eyes off of the screen. I don't have notifications flashing up. Like, I can concentrate and pay attention and focus more for even if it's 20 minutes. But I do think that the challenge of 100 years ago was that we didn't have enough information. And I think the challenge maybe today is that we may have too much.
So interesting. It's so interesting and how to how to balance it out. Because like you said, our ancestors would be salivating.
Have you started using a fountain pen yet in writing?
No, not yet.
Try that one next. That really slows it down. Whenever I need to chill out, that's what I'll do.
I find like I retain information better writing it as opposed to typing it. I think I'm the same with reading a physical copy as opposed to audiobook. Pom, did you narrate it yourself, or did you get someone to read the audiobook?
I read the entire thing myself.
Okay, nice, cool. All right, want to get you out of here. I got a few more things. Oh, I just wanted to go over some of the, well, not go over some of the chapters, but just give people a sneak preview some of the chapters I liked. I've talked about a bunch on this podcast, Pomp. I think it's chapter one, how you do anything is how you do everything. Love that concept. Excellence doesn't have a watch. Life is full of power laws. Your intuition is your algorithm. So guys, go out there, get that book. Some real good stuff. It's just like, there's a couple of miscellaneous things I wanted to ask you, Pomp, and I'll get you going here. Decline in the U.S. population growth rate. What are your thoughts on that? Like, what do you think is driving this?
I mean, the simple answer is like, we're having less kids, right? But I think that that is also the lazy answer, because it begs the question, why are we having less kids? And there are probably, a number of different trends that contribute, all in different ways. You know, the rise of professional women. If you're at work, you're not at home, right? And vice versa. And there's a very strong argument that's also been good for society, right? That more of our citizens are working and being productive and following their dreams and all that stuff. But that's definitely one. I think a second one is a decline in religion.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about something as simple as, there's a lot of religions where using any sort of birth control is looked down upon. Yep. And so naturally there was just less of that and more children. I think that there is a lot to do with economics and just like the cost of living. I saw something recently that broke down by state how much it costs per year for a kid. And it's like 20 grand. On average across the country, it's a lot of money, yep. Right? And so like there's just people say, I can't afford it. I do think that although it's a small impact, there are some insane people who are like, I'm not going to have kids because of climate change, which like, I mean, it's just idiotic, but like definitely there are some people who say that. And then I think also the rise of like online communication means less people are actually meeting in person. Mm. Less people meeting in person probably means, we know the rise of male virgins is much higher. And so people are having less sex, less often, and they're going longer into their life before they find a partner. And so naturally, just like math, right? You know, if 50 years ago, people started having kids at, you know, in their early 20s, and now they're not having them until they're in their late 20s, you're probably, you know, going to have less kids. And so you could even go a step lower and like, hey, well, how do you solve all those problems? We don't got time to try to solve them, right? But like, it's a very fascinating issue that you can't pinpoint one single thing. And you got to say, hey, each one of these is kind of a contributor. And so maybe the problem can't be solved.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like you said, all these factors. And another factor I heard thrown out, or like people saying, is kind of like, you know, there's that adage. It's like, oh, like your life is, you know, your life's over when you have kids or something. And it's actually like probably quite the opposite. I mean, like I think any parent say like your life is like more fulfilling, better having kids. But I think it's like maybe that scares people off as well. Like you can't live life anymore or something. But all right. Last two things here. We'll keep it short. We got an election coming up. Are you hopeful? I know people, you know, obviously things are very polarizing. Are you more like hopeful for politics going forward in the U.S.? Do you see things improving or nervous, or what are your thoughts there?
The single greatest moment and glimmer of hope in the last couple of months to me was the vice presidential debate between J.D. Vance and Tim Walz.
Yeah.
Regardless of which side, you know, you're cheering for or you're going to vote for or whatever, this idea of like vigorous but respectful debate, yeah, I thought was really an encouraging sign. And to me, that if we can get back to that, you get the, you know, kind of maybe it's nostalgia, but like the civility of the past. Hopefully is, you know, a sign of things to come, but there's a lot of problems, man. You know, we've just talked about the economic ones, you know, there's a lot of stuff we got, to handle on. And I think the only thing that I would say is, it's a good reminder that like leadership matters.
For sure.
Regardless of whether you vote, you know, red, blue, green, whatever. It's just like, we need strong leaders. And having strong leaders, I think, history will show, you know, is great as a deterrent from a national security standpoint. It's great from an economic leadership standpoint. And really, strength equals confidence. And when people have confidence in the U.S. and the U.S. economy and our political system, I think we're better off.
For sure. For sure. I couldn't agree anymore. It was so nice to see, civility, and respect, even if differing, opinions. Last thing here, Pomp, you obviously have a lot of interests. You do a lot of things. I guess like my personal question to you is like, how do you make sure you're not spreading yourself too thin?
I don't. I do a horrible job of it. Let's just be honest. no, I mean, I try as hard as I can to, you know, kind of box my time. I try as hard as I can to avoid kind of getting overexposed to, you know, certain aspects, whatever. But the short answer is, I do a bad job and I'm just okay with that. You know, I do the best that I can. But I got a lot of shit going on. I'm enjoying life. And probably if I had somebody come in and like audit me, they'd be like, hey, dude, get rid of this, get rid of that, whatever. And maybe I need to do that. But as of right now, you know, I just do the best I can.
Awesome. Awesome. And that's going to conclude today's episode of Confessions of a Market Maker. If you guys enjoyed this episode, please rate and review it for us. If you'd like to join a supportive and professional trading room, you can join us at microefutures.com. Pomp, let the people know where they can find you. Anything else you want them to know?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yep, hear you.
You can just go, Twitter's the best place, at A Pompliano on Twitter, or actually Substack, just pompletter.com.
Awesome, awesome. JJ, parting thoughts?
Oh, thanks so much for joining us. It's like a breath of fresh air. Come back and you know, give us your wisdom more often. Our listeners would really appreciate that. Thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate you guys having me.
All right. Thanks a lot. So for Anthony Pompliano, I'm Paulie Walnuts. He's the gorilla of House Street. You stop, though. So.